Where is God's country? Is it here? Is it our homeland? Is it a place that we find beautiful? What about the parts that we do not call home? What about the parts of the earth that we do not think are beautiful? Well, brethren, the whole earth is God's country. And you just sang it. So I hope you believe it. But the whole earth is God's country according to the man whom the Bible says he was a man after God's own way of thinking. And also, he is a man who is inspired by the Holy Spirit to write that of which I am speaking. Then again, no place on this earth is our permanent home. And so we look forward to going to our true home where God dwells, which is truly God's country. For its beauty is beyond imagination. Today I'd like us to take a look at Psalm 24 and see there what the Spirit of God through King David says is God's country. Psalm 24, starting with verse 1. The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein. Let us not speak evil of God's possession, as is frequently done with the land to the east. Moreover, all the earth's fullness belongs to the Lord, and everything that we have is on loan from God. King David again keeps this in mind in 1 Chronicles chapter 29 in a beautiful and magnificent prayer to God. And we do well to remember what he says in this prayer. For then we shall be like David, a man whose heart was like the heart of God. 1 Chronicles 29, beginning at verse 11, he prays to God. Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power and the glory, the victory and the majesty. For all, he says, that is in heaven and in earth, all that is in earth, including all of the earth, is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head over all. Both riches and honor come from you, and you reign over all. In your hand is power and might. In your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. Now, therefore, our God, we thank you and praise your glorious name. But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer so willingly as this? For all things come from you, and of your own we have given you. For we are aliens and pilgrims before you, as were all our fathers. Our days on earth are as a shadow and without hope, O Lord our God. All this abundance that we have prepared to build you a house for your holy name is from your hand, and all and is all your own. The emphasis of David's prayer is the same thing as what he was writing in Psalm 24. This whole earth is God's. All its fullness is His. Therefore, anything I have and anything I may give back to Him is simply that. I'm giving it back to Him. Yes, He has allowed me to possess it for a while, but ultimately it is all His. Every single part of this planet. Next, in Psalm 24, David emphasizes that the world, still there in verse 1, is the Lord's. The land and all its activity that we call the world belongs to our God. Those who dwell here are His. Moses once began a prayer by saying, in reference to God, that He is the God of the spirits of all flesh. That's found in Numbers chapter 27. Therefore, we should not speak evil of others, even of those who come from the land south of here, because they have as much right to be here as any of God's people anywhere on this earth. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul makes an application of our very text that in dealing with unbelievers and believers, we need to be guided with or by Psalm 24:1. How do I deal with people who live around me? How do I deal with people in this town, in other places where I go, in my work and in my home and so on? He says Psalm 24, verse 1, needs to be a guide. I'm going to start clear back at verse 23 so that we can get Paul's thoughts as he approaches his use of Psalm 24. And here's what he says in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 23. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no questions for conscience' sake. For the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. If any of those who do not believe invite you to dinner and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience' sake. But if anyone says to you, this was offered to idols, do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you and for conscience' sake, for the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? But if I partake with thanks, why am I evil spoken of for the food over which I give thanks? Therefore, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. And his basis for saying that is because the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell in it. Verse 33, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. Therefore, we have to be careful of what we say of other people, of their things, of their food, of their possessions, and so on. Because any attitude that I have and then express, Paul is arguing, is actually a reflection upon God. Because God owns those people. And God owns their things. And He owns their land from where they come. Well, and here's why the earth is the Lord's. Psalm 24 now, verse 2. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the waters. God is the creator of the earth. Now, at first, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And then suddenly, God brings form and fullness to the earth. So that what we see in creation now is the deliberate design of our God. Having spoken of the earth in verses 1 and 2 here of Psalm 24, David now moves to a specific place. And he'll address that in verses 3 through 6. Who gets to ascend the hill of the Lord? Verse 3 says this: Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in His holy place? Why does David bring this up after confessing the ownership of the earth? Well, the world belongs to the Lord, therefore the people do also, so it is up to Him who gets to dwell in His holy hill. The hill of Zion is the hill of God, even as the city of Jerusalem is the city of God. And these are types and shadows, you might call them, of heaven itself, which is the true hill and the true city of God. So who may go there? Who may first go into that holy hill of God that was located there in ancient Jerusalem, but now, in the true spiritual sense, who may ascend into God's hill in heaven itself? Who may go there? Well, David's arguing that the earth is for everyone, but the hill is for a select group. Who is in this group? Can I be included within it? Here's what God wants to see. Verse 4. He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to an idol, nor sworn deceitfully. He who has clean hands, that is, what he does is not defiled by the world. He who has a pure heart, because even within, not just what he does, but even what he is on the inside, he maintains purity. He has not lifted up his soul to an idol, knowing that idolatry insults God. The true God is far greater than a piece of stone or wood or anything else that we may own. Why then should the idolater dwell with God? And he who has not sworn deceitfully. He who swears deceitfully is using the name of God for personal gain. He's not interested in God. So that person's not going to dwell with God in His holy hill. But the person that he's listing here is going to receive a blessing when he gets there on top of it. Verse 5 now says, He shall receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such a person ascends God's holy hill and stands in His holy place, but that is not all. Once we arrive, we learn of other blessings. I think generally we just think about going to heaven. And that's good. We just want to get there. Who cares what God does with us or what He gives us or whatever once we get there? I just want to get there. But I think the point is that it's not just a privilege to be there. But once we are there, He gives us blessings as well. And the blessing, according to verse 5 here, is righteousness. But the materialistic mind does not see that as a blessing. How can just righteousness, or being righteous, or living in a place where there's nothing but righteousness, how can that be a blessing? That kind of mind sees blessings as nothing more than material things or gratification of selfish or fleshly desires. But David goes on in verse 6 by showing that these are the people who seek God's face. Again he says, this is Jacob, the generation of those who seek him, who seek your face. Selah, a musical term. He who seeks the face of God, he says, is of Jacob. They are not all Jacob who are of Jacob. But whoever shares in the spiritual qualities that made Jacob a man of God is of Jacob. And that's the generation, he says, who shall be with God in his holy hill, enjoying his righteousness. He who has dirty hands, a wicked heart, lifts up his soul to idols, and swears deceitfully, has no desire to see God's face. In fact, he does everything he can to avoid it. Even as it is written in Revelation chapter 6, that the time comes for that person or those people to meet God. And having a mountain fall on them is far more desirable than to meet God himself. John prophesies of them, saying that they will say to the mountains and to the caves, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Now as we come back to Psalm 24, we learn that someone has entered into the hill and through the gates of the city before us. In verses 7 through 10, David now speaks about the King of Glory arriving at his city. Let's start with verse 7. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in. A forerunner commands the gates to open because the King of Glory is ready to enter his city. But what is the connection here with what is said here, as you see starting in verse 7 here, with the previous parts of the passage or of this psalm? In verses 7 through 10, David speaks as though the King of Glory is among men. Because David is telling the gates of the city to be opened up for this king. And this is the king who has created all things. This is the king who decides who ascends into the holy hill of Zion. Therefore, welcome him into his city. Because it is his city, and he is the great King of Glory. In fact, welcome him wherever he wants to go on this earth. Now look at the question that is asked in verse 8 and then the answer. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. David's not talking about himself. He's not talking about a mighty foreign king. He's talking about the Lord himself, about God. So the order goes out. Open up gates. The King of Glory is coming. The question comes back, who is this King of Glory? This city is not for anyone or just anyone who happens to call himself a king. Rather, this king who is coming to this city is strong and mighty, David says, especially in battle. Jesus Christ demonstrated his great power in the battle that he fought against the devil at the cross. What greater or mightier king do we have than that? Indeed, he is the Lord that he's speaking about here, and he is a Lord who has been in battle. He has fought the devil, and he has won. Let him into his city. And this makes, I believe, Jesus the glorious king. So again, listen to what verse 9 says. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and lift them up, you everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in. After the identification the announcement is repeated. Since he is the rightful king, let him in. Open those gates. Open the gates of heaven itself as Jesus ascends back into heaven. Open them up. What a scene that must have been. Have you ever thought about that before? On that day when Jesus was on the earth with his apostles, he had not yet ascended up into heaven in the way that this passage is talking about. Because you'll recall that Mary, when she saw, one of the Marys, when she saw Jesus at the tomb, she fell down and wrapped herself around his feet, and he said not to do that because he had not yet ascended to the Father. Jesus is still down on the earth, and heaven sees him down on the earth. But at some point, the clouds come and take him up and bring him up to heaven. What a sight that must have been. And in the book of Daniel, that sight is prophesied. In Daniel chapter 7, you get a little glimpse. All of a sudden, we're transported to heaven, and you can see the King of Glory ascending up into heaven. As I told you before, I plan on preaching through the book of Daniel, Lord willing, next year, which is almost upon us. I can't wait to get to that passage to look at that thrilling moment when Jesus Christ, the King of Glory, strong and mighty, mighty in battle, has put down the devil, gained the victory for us, and he enters into his glorious city. Man, I wish I was there to have seen the reception that he received. Verse 10 again says, who is this King of Glory? As though now, you know, heaven can now answer back. He is the Lord of hosts. He is the King of Glory. The question comes back again, and now all of heaven answers. His title is King of Glory, but his name is Lord, you'll notice, in all caps, telling us not just Lord as a title, but this is referring to God's name. This is Jehovah. This is Yahweh of hosts. That's who Jesus is. And no wonder heaven was thrilled to receive him. God is back. He's been on the field of battle, and he's coming back to claim his throne. So here's David making the announcement in the Spirit, and now heaven makes the same announcement, and how grand that announcement must have been. We want to ascend up into the hill of the Lord. But first, we have to let Him descend into our hearts. We want to stand in His holy place. But we have to let Him stand in our holy hearts first. We want to enter through the gates of His city of glory. But we have to let Him enter through the gates of the hearts, of our hearts of glory. Jesus has to find a place there. We open up the gates. He could force them open. But He chooses not to do so. He wants us to open them of our own accord because we love Him and we cherish Him. He wants us to open up the hearts that we might let Him in. And when we do that, we're now ready to follow Him wherever He leads us. Friends, if you've never been baptized into Jesus Christ before, if you're not in Him and He's not in you, please don't leave this morning without that having taken place. If we can render any assistance to you in walking closer to Jesus or being with Him in the first place, please come forward right now as we stand and sing.